I'm Kristen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
I go by KC most of the time, but a lot of people call me, so I get two hellos. I'm really grateful to be here. Can everyone hear me okay? I'm very grateful to be here. I'm very grateful for this program of recovery that I credit with saving my life. My first speaker meeting was 20 years ago, almost to the day. I was asked to do it when I had 12 months sober in Las Vegas. And I did it grudgingly. I have had a terrible public speaking anxiety. I still have a little bit of it, so forgive me if I lose my train of thought or my voice quivers. It will go away because when I'm speaking about something I'm passionate about, I tend to just focus on what I'm saying, and I'm very passionate about recovery. Like I said, I got sober 21 years ago. I was in Las Vegas, and when I did that first speaker meeting, they told me, you got to give it away to keep it. And in sharing my experience, strength, and hope, I might help others get sober. And they said some other thing that I didn't really understand at the time, but I do now, and that's that I get as much as I give, if not more. And whenever I'm of service and whenever I am lucky enough to be asked to share my story or to be of service in some way, to take someone to a meeting, what I find is that it reinforces my sobriety and it gives me an expanded understanding, and it helps keep me sober. And so I was told also at that meeting that I should just keep it simple. In fact, the meeting was called the Kiss Club, and the meeting was 8:15 a.m., 45-minute Sun Kiss meeting, and they said, just tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I think that formula still holds. What it was like, I will say that long before I took my first drink, my life, what it was like for me was isolating. I felt very isolated. I was the middle of five kids. I had two parents who loved me. I did not necessarily feel that from my mother especially, but my parents were very good people. I had a very difficult relationship with my mother, and so I felt isolated within my own family. I did not feel loved. I did not feel worth love. I felt very insecure. And I was always looking for outward sources. I was dependent on everyone else to continually be telling me I was okay. And the way that started was in my house. Again, my parents are really good people, but they worked very long hours. They had four kids right in a row. My mother had clinical depression, and she was not of a generation where therapy was recommended. There was stigma, a lot of stigma. And everyone in the family had their own ways of sort of dealing with her depression and her rage and the tension in our household. You know, there was sort of a way of detaching, of pretending it wasn't happening, of people-pleasing, you know, whatever the others could do. Well, I came along, and my way was to just demand loudly, I want more. I want more love. I want more attention. I want more nurturing. And, that didn't really work, unfortunately, for me. So I just got louder. My mother told me a story very recently that about when I was an infant. I was just 3, 6 months old, something like that. And, you know, she had two very quiet, very passive, very agreeable children, and then I came along, and I just would not stop crying. And my dad's word, I came out screaming, and I haven't stopped since. And My father is a really good man, but he's not anybody's protector necessarily. He was raised to not see to tune out pain and conflict, which, you know, is good when you're raised on a dirt farm and you have, you know, no insulation and barely enough food, but it's not so great when you have kids who are in pain. And so my mother didn't know what to do with me this one night. You know, she said, I burped you, I fed you, I changed you, I rocked you, nothing worked. And I started, and she makes this shaking motion, and then she stops talking, and she says, well, your dad came in, and he put you in the crib, and we shut the door, and you just cried and cried and cried, and eventually you stopped. And she says this in a way that, to let me know how hard I was and that, you know, what a good mom she was, and it was a win. And the truth is, she did have it hard. She had a lot on her shoulders, but I know what happens now when children don't get that soothing that they need from their parents. And what I learned in that moment and many moments afterwards was that I would never get the nurturing and the soothing and the love that I needed. I did not feel safe in this world. I did not feel attuned with my mother. I did not feel connected to the rest of my family. And then when my father went through bankruptcy when I was a teenager, it was a very difficult, traumatic sort of thing. We lost everything. We lost our home and our friends, and we moved to Texas and lived in a very small, cramped place. And I was very different. I had a punk rock haircut, and it was like that Footloose scene my first day in high school, you know. Everybody got real quiet, and they sort of made a space for me to walk down the hall. So again, I was an outsider, which was becoming a real pattern for me. But I started drinking. I had had a few drinks at 15, and they got away from me very quickly. As soon as there started to be anything I didn't know how to handle, which was basically anything, I had no coping skills. I just drank, and it was. In those early years, I think my way of dealing with my mother's rage, when the loudness and the demands for her attention didn't work, I just started dissociating. You know, when someone is yelling at you and you can't take it, but you can't run away, and you just sort of slip into this place in your head, and you block yourself off, you wall yourself off from the pain of the shame and the self-loathing that you're filling with. And I know for me, I thought, you know, I'm a genius. I can't believe I figured this out. I just kind of put up this wall and I'm safe back here, and she can yell, and I'm like, it bounces right off me. And what I didn't realize as a kid, you know, I'm 8, 10, 12, whatever, I didn't realize that when I wall myself off from pain, I also wall myself off from joy. And so as a teen, what I discovered with my first drink, which was given to me by a very handsome doctor I was babysitting for, he gave me a shot of tequila at age 14, and I had my first drink, and all of a sudden, I was pretty, and I was funny, and I was engaging, and I was just the bomb. And then he drove me home, and I floated upstairs to bed thinking, where do I get some more of this shit? Yeah, I just found my answer to life. Now I understand why other people can make friends and smile and just seem like they have it all together. And so we moved shortly after that, and that's when I started drinking. I became a weekend binge drinker very quickly. Excuse me. And so I, 2 years later, I moved to Austin to go to college, and I had no self-belief whatsoever. Really wanted to be a writer, but no one had ever asked me what I wanted to do. A couple of teachers had. In fact, they told me I was a good writer. But by then, I was too far gone to believe them, and I had such a fear of failure and such shame wrapped up in the idea of failing, of trying to write and being no good, that I didn't really try anymore after high school. I did write a couple short stories, I think, shortly after high school, but I I went to UT and I was, you know, that very common story. I'm an alcoholic already at 17. And I had this great group of friends here because I knew someone who lived here. It was like my best friend. And he introduced me to all the cool punks, all the friendly punks, you know. But there was this other segment over here. There were these speed punks, these meth heads. And they were just very intriguing to me. And I very quickly went off in that direction. Yeah. You know, you've been there. Something, yeah, I don't know. I was definitely being pulled in that direction. And I was offered some speed, and alcohol was my gateway drug. I went straight from alcohol, and I did a little acid and mushrooms, maybe my first month here. But as soon as someone offered me some speed, and she offered it to me to snort while she shot up, I thought, no, I want to be tough like you. I want to do it that way. So by the time my second semester started, a few months later, I was a raging speed freak. And I had blown all my scholarships and grant money on it, and I'd been robbed a number of times. I'd been beaten. I'd been abducted. I'd been robbed a few more times. And then I quit. So I had a six-month, very intense, very quick addiction to speed, and then I got my act together, and I started stripping and started paying back those school loans, and eventually went back to ACC, back to school at ACC. And at 20 years old, my drinking was pretty out of control, but I worked in a bar. You know, everyone around me drank. It was very normalized. I drank a little bit more than everyone else, but, you know, just this much more. Now, out there in society, I was drinking this much more than everybody else. But right around that time, I was just slowly starting to figure out who I was. Because that's the other thing. I was dependent on drugs just to make me feel okay with myself, as opposed to really stepping into myself and developing myself as a person or a writer or a woman or any of that stuff. And so around that time, I met a very successful musician and fell in love very quickly. And he was also he was twice my age. He was 40, I was 20. And he was also a longtime coke addict and alcoholic. And so very quickly, within a few months, I started using coke. And again, everyone around me, all the musicians, you know, his whole rock star crowd, you know, most of them were doing coke. Most of them were drinking the way we were drinking. And so it was normalized. And this time it was a little glamorous. You know, I wasn't hanging out with punks and sleeping in my car. I was sleeping in five-star hotels and flying first class. And so it was a very convenient way for me to tell myself that I didn't really have a problem. I mean, I didn't need to get up and go to work. You know, I could do a three-day binge every week. If my boyfriend wasn't going to quit, it would make no sense for me to quit, right? I mean, if he quit, then maybe I would quit. That's what I thought. But I didn't really want to quit. I just wanted to get my identity from this position as a rock star's girlfriend. I wanted to be dependent on him for my, not just identity, for my room and board and food and travel and the rest of my life. And I my goals, my dreams of writing went out the window. I call myself the queen of inaction, because it was so much easier to just follow him along, do what he said. Where are we going? What are we doing? Who are our friends going to be? You know, it was, how is our sex going to be? What are we going to talk about? What are we not going to talk about? Because if I chose a different kind of life or a different kind of activity, or if I tried to do anything individual on my own and then I failed, I don't think I could have handled the shame of not being a great writer right out of the gate, or of telling him I want to hang out with my friends instead of yours, and have and he not having a good time with them. And if I just did what he wanted to do, if I just allowed myself to be dependent on that relationship in that way, then whatever went wrong was not really my fault. So it was a way of not being accountable and not being responsible for my own life. It was a way of being completely dependent, because I believe that my dependency manifested in more ways than just on substances. My dependency it manifested in every way, in every relationship, drugs, alcohol, food. The list goes on and on, but we'll get to that later. So after about 5 years, I end up blowing out my septum, and I start smoking crack. And I rationalize this by telling myself, well, I have to preserve my nose. And I was good at the rationalization. So that didn't go over so well with him, but we stayed together. And then, you know, things were really spiraling, as they will in addiction. And so we ended up breaking up. And then we got back together, and he got sober right around the time we got back together. And so since he wasn't paying for the coke anymore, I didn't do coke anymore, but my drinking again spiraled, because drinking was really my first love. It was what I started with, it was what I ended with, and it was the only thing I really could not give up. I could give up coke, I could give up meth, I could give up crack. I couldn't give up alcohol. I drank daily for pretty much for 12 years, almost daily. But when we broke up, I moved to Vegas with a guy who was, let's say a step down. He was a homeless veteran with PTSD, and he was a good man in some ways, but he didn't know how to control his temper, and so he beat me up and went to jail. And when that was over, I did my best to make my life work, but I just felt like I had no identity. And when I knew that my boyfriend in L.A., the love of my life, was not coming back, I decided I had no reason to live and that I was going to drink myself to death. And the reason I decided that was because I thought it would actually be, well, for one thing, a way to not make a hard decision, because I was not very good at making decisions. I wasn't proactive. I just wanted things to happen. I wanted to follow him around, or follow life around, or follow my alcoholism around. And so I just followed my alcoholism to the logical conclusion, which to me was death. I wasn't quite ready to blow my brains out or slit my wrists. So this went on for 22 months. I lived in Las Vegas, and I drank as much as I could. I worked just enough to keep a roof over my head. And 22 months later, I lay on what I assumed was going to be my deathbed. I'd been in and out of the hospital. I'd had alcohol poisoning a few times and a kidney infection. And I was very bloated. I was very yellow. People, total strangers, looked at me on the street and they just would gasp that everybody expected me to die. I had cut off all of my family. Those relationships were rather difficult. I was still close with one sister, but I had decided to cut off all the ties. I was going to stop listening to music, stop looking at sunsets. I was just going to cut off everything that might bring me joy or make me feel tied to earth. And when the day came, it'd be easier to let go. So when that day came and I woke up in my friend Chuck's bed, feeling more pain than I ever actually knew was possible to feel, unable to move and unable to talk, and sicker than I'd ever been, projectile vomiting green bile repeatedly off to the side of the bed, I thought, well, okay, I may have gotten what I'm after. I've been working hard for this. I've accomplished something. I haven't gotten a book published. I haven't accomplished anything major, but I put my mind to something, and I I went out, and I'm this close to getting it done, and I had to lay there because I had nothing else I could do. I couldn't move. I couldn't talk. I couldn't dial a phone. I couldn't get out of bed. All I could do was lay there, and I could feel my pulse and look at the clock on the wall, and I could see that I could tell that my heart was over 200 beats a minute, and it went on for hours. And as I lay there, my brain was working perfectly. My body wasn't working at all, but I lay there and asking myself, why am I not more excited about this? This is what I'm after, and it's almost here. And that's when the veil lifted, and I had to admit to myself what I'd been in denial about, which was that this was not what I believed was right. It's not how I was meant to go. I was someone who believed in a higher power. I called him God at that point. I feel actually somewhat lucky in that regard, because I believe as hard as recovery was for me, it was this much easier because I never didn't believe in something. What I believed at that time was that there was a God, and God loved all of us and gave us all a purpose, and then I had screwed up really badly, so God had given up on me, and why wouldn't he? I mean, I would have given up on me, too. I had given up on me. And so as I lay there, I thought, maybe if I have a purpose, if I had a purpose, and I check out like this, I'm going to have to come back and complete it another time. And I didn't like that idea very much. I thought I might have to go through high school again. I thought I would come back with all the same problems I had, but I would have to go through high school again. And I decided 4 or 5 hours into all of this that if I lived through the day, I would ask for help getting sober. Now, what that meant to me was that one of the strippers I worked with in Vegas, she had been sober for 2 years, and she had told me many times that she was saving me a seat. And so I thought, I'll call her, I'll go to these meetings, I'll work those damn steps, I'll prove they don't work, and then I can drink myself to death with a clear conscience. So that was my plan. And a couple days later, I was able to get out of bed, and I was very frail and very weak, but I got in the car and I drove 4 blocks to a 7-Eleven type store. Because I was out of cigarettes, and I really wanted a cigarette. And when I walked in, shuffling on my skinny, weak legs, I went right past the cigarettes and right up to that refrigerator where they keep all the cheap wine that I'd been living on for a long time. And I stood there, and I looked at it for a very, very long time. I could barely stand upright, and I started shaking, because I wanted it so badly. But I also knew where it would lead. And it was in that moment that I admitted I was completely powerless. And I started crumbling. And I just pivoted, and I stumbled out into the car. I dove inside, slammed the door, and started sobbing my brains out. And when I caught my breath, I put the car in gear and I drove back to Chuck's house, 4 blocks away, except for there was a pub halfway there. And my arms betrayed me and they pulled in. And I threw it into park and I started beating up the inside of my car. I didn't get out. And when my hands were bruised and I was spent, I just lost it. In my head, I screamed as loudly as I could to whatever God there was, help me, please help me. Do something, my way is not working anymore. And that is when I came to believe that a power greater than me might restore me to sanity. And a calm came over me completely. And I put it back into gear, and I drove 2 more blocks to Chuck's. And at Chuck's house, I started getting a little wonky again pretty quickly. And I called him at work, And I said, this is too hard. I can't do it. It's too hard. I can't do it. And he tried to calm me down. And I started screaming at him and slammed down the phone. And then I just sat my ass down and I stayed there. And I said, I'm not leaving this house today. If I die, I'll die. If I go crazy, I'll go crazy. But I'm not leaving this house today. That wine will be there tomorrow, I'm pretty sure. They're not going to wipe it all out overnight. That thought actually is what allowed me to do it. Somewhere along the line, I'd heard one day at a time. And it stuck. I had been to one meeting. I didn't understand anything anyone said. It wasn't actually a very good meeting. There were only a few people there. But something stuck, and I got through the day. And then I started going to AA meetings. And I probably had 4 or 5 days sober. And I walked in, and I sat down, and I was very quiet, and I'm sure I had my arms crossed. And I listened to everything, everybody sharing. And there were 15 or so people in that meeting. And they were all different kinds of people. There was a financial guy. There was a bartender. There was a Mormon housewife. There was a sugar baby. There was a stripper. There was a construction worker. All kinds of people. Some of the best people in the world there. And they were talking about humility, and I hated them. I hated every damn one of them. I thought they were loony. What the hell does humility have to do with anything? I'm fucking dying here, people. But they were very nice to me, and they kept telling me to come back, and they seemed to think that they understood me, even though they clearly didn't, because they were loony. But they were nice. And whatever they were doing was working for them. You know, it was not going to work for me. And I just thought, well, I'll go back once in a while, because the truth is I had nowhere else to go. And so I started going back every few days, every 2 days, and then every day. And after a couple of months, I've been studying those steps they had posted on the wall, and I thought, okay, those seem easy enough. I think those first three I've already done, right? So I'll get started on that fourth step. So I asked somebody, you know, is there like a guide somewhere that I can... And he said, you know, you're really supposed to be working with someone else. It kind of works better that way. So I went, oh, Christ, these people. All right, I'm going to do it their way because I got to prove it doesn't work. Got to do it their way. And I asked this girl who'd led me to the meeting in the first place if she'd be my sponsor, and she said yes. And it was probably one of the smartest things I've ever done in my life. And I'll tell you why. Jessica was the kind of sponsor who taught me the steps as they are laid out in the big book. She did not tell me to do anything extra. She did not make up shit for me to do. She didn't tell me not to date anyone for a year. She didn't tell me to call her every day. She didn't tell me which meetings I had to go. She made a lot of recommendations. She said I should go to meetings every day. I should go to women's meetings. I should probably not date for a year. I should probably not strip for a year. I didn't listen to her most. I listened to her about half that stuff. I did what she said when I could. But she sat down and she walked me through the steps. She said, we're going to read out of this book together, out loud. We're going to take turns. And that felt a little corny, but whatever, I'll do it. And the first time we got together, we read and we got up to the third step. And then she says, I want to ask you something. It's a simple question, but I want you to think about it. Are you right now willing to do anything it takes to stay sober? Now, I had one foot in the grave just a couple months earlier. I had nothing else. If I were to drink again, I was going to die. So it was a pretty simple answer. I said, yeah, I'm willing to do anything. And then she says, okay, so I want you to say this prayer with me. And I could have killed her, because that's about the one thing I was not prepared to do. Because I felt like I'd been abandoned by everyone who was supposed to take care of me. I didn't get the love I needed from my boyfriend, from my mother, from the man upstairs. And now I'm supposed to get humble and ask him to help me. That did not sit well with me. It was a very humbling moment. But I had just freaking told her I was going to do it, so I did it. And it wasn't all that bad. It was okay. Yeah, I eventually learned to love that prayer, and I used to say it every single day, and I did for years. And then she taught me the fourth step, and she says, the first thing you're going to do is get a notebook. And that took about a week because I had to get one that was just the right color with just the right amount of space between the lines. It was a very, very involved project, that. So I got myself a notebook with 100 pages in which she says, you can write out all your resentments. I thought, I like, now I'm liking this. This is getting a little bit better. I'll write out my resentments, all right. And they each got a page, everyone I was mad at, every institution, every person got a whole page. And then I had to write out my part in it, which was not nearly as fun, but I did it. And it took me a month to go through my resentments, my part in it, what was affected, what was causing them, what I could have done better, what was it like from the other side, what was my mother thinking, what was she going through, what were my fears, what did I do to set those balls in motion. And then my sexual misconduct. She said she wanted me to write out a list of everyone that I'd been with and possibly harmed in a romantic or sexual way. And I said, Jesus, Jessica, I'm running out of paper here. She says, she was a Vegas stripper too. She says, I'm not impressed. I got you beat. And I did fill up 90 pages in the end of that notebook. And it felt amazing. I worked on it every other day for a month. And then I went over to her house to read it to her. And it took all afternoon. And when we were done, I had this very clear picture of the patterns in my life that had led me to this very self-destructive place where I was... nothing about my life was working. Nothing. And... I finally saw why. I finally saw all these character flaws, all these things that I was in denial about and convinced myself were, you know, logical and of integrity. And she said, now go home and read step 6 and 7 to yourself. We'll get together next week. Talk about step 8. So I went home and I read step 6 and 7, and I just had a complete and utter meltdown. And I called her sobbing. It was Christmas shopping, and so I had a breakdown at Walmart or a Target or something. I'm in the rain. I get to the car and I'm like crying into the phone. She can't understand me, and she finally figures out that I'm having a hard time with 6 and 7, and she says, these are like the easiest things you're going to do in recovery. I mean, I think you might be making this a little harder than it needs to be. And I said, how do you think I've gotten by for 30 years? I need my self-seeking. I need my greed. I am motivated by envy. I need my dishonesty. It is how I have taken care of myself for the last 30 fucking years. And now you want me to give it up. There's going to be nothing left of me. The last time there was nothing left of me, I tried to kill myself. Anyway, we got off the phone. We never did resolve that. She didn't quite get it. But I thought, you know, I'm not a published writer, but I do like to write. I do well when I write. Maybe I can figure this thing out if I just open up a notebook. And I started writing. And I wrote out a list of every single character flaw that had come up, and even some more that hadn't. And across from those, I wrote out their opposite. Instead of being greedy, I could be generous. Instead of being disingenuous, I could be authentic. Instead of being dishonest, I could be honest. I mean, what a concept. And when I took a good hard look at that list, I thought, you know, I would like to be that person. I would really like to be that person. I don't know what, I don't know how the world's going to handle it. I don't know how far she's going to get in life, but, you know, my way wasn't working, so I did it. I acted my way into right thinking. And at the time, you know, I thought that was just another kind of cool slogan. I thought the slogans were kind of cool, most of them, you know, but... I also was pretty sure I was the exception to most of them. But no, acting your way into right thinking actually works. And in that respect, and I'm not atheist, but even if I was, I feel like that could have been my higher power. The program worked for me. And I continued with them. I wrote out my amends letters, and I had to get real humble and go up to everyone in my family that I had felt very disconnected from and very misunderstood by and very hurt by. And I had to tell them I was sorry for my part in it. And to a man, all they said was, oh, it's okay. We just want you to be sober. That's all we want. And I got a little buzz off of that. I got a little addicted to making amends. I mean, I couldn't stop making them. I was getting into it. I was on a pink cloud for a while, in fact, and I really wanted to stay sober. And I lost my desire to drink at about the 5-month mark. And I developed an eating disorder, and my depression, my lifelong depression, came back. These were things I had to work on, and it took a very long time. But I moved back to Austin, and I started sponsoring other women. I was praying, and I was meditating on a regular basis, and I was working the steps, and I was going to meetings. And then when it came to step 12, I had 2 years sober, and I really kind of thought I was going to do 2/3 of that shit and, you know, leave it alone. I really thought I was going to be too busy with my new fabulous sober life, which wasn't all that fabulous quite yet. But I did think I was going to be busy. The truth was also that I did not quite think I had anything that would help other people very much. You know, I didn't still quite believe in myself that way. And yet I was also told not to say no. I, when it comes to being of service, just say yes. You just got to say yes. And every single thing they taught me in this program, they were right about. Everyone. You know that thing about don't dating? Nobody wanted to date me that first year. Let me say that first of all. So that one wasn't actually that hard for me. But if somebody I wanted to date had wanted to date me, I would have dated him. But all the other stuff, the stuff that's in the book, you know, the steps, which are the program, all that stuff worked. And so I grudgingly started sponsoring women. And the first time I took a woman who was very motivated and very dedicated, and she had been addicted to painkillers all through her teens. She couldn't have been but 22 or something. And she'd had migraines, and for all through her teens, they'd had her on some serious pain meds. And then she'd spiraled. By the time I took her through the steps, exactly as Jessica had taken me through them, as they are laid out in the big book with no extra shit, we sat down and we went over the 12 step together. And I got up off that picnic table where we were out in the park, and I walked to my car, and I felt overcome with the sensation of being high as a kite. It was amazing. It was like a big, fat, burly jolt of speed. Yeah, it was a beautiful thing. And like I said, life got better kind of slowly. Some things got better very quickly. Other things took a long time. It has been 21 years, and God willing, if I don't drink between now and Wednesday morning, it will be 21 years. And I did finally, I went to meetings every day, sometimes twice a day for 7 years. I went to conferences, I did speaker meetings. I mean, I lived and breathed AA. I was at that Joe and Charlie Laughlin seminar, and it changed my life, and I eventually stopped going after 7 years very regularly. I couldn't find anyone. My sponsor had moved out of town, and I couldn't find anyone to sponsor me. Everyone was too busy. And I took that personally, and so I stopped going quite so much. But I took the steps with me. I worked those steps and the principles that they represent every day in my life, and I don't do it perfectly. But the program comes with me. And so I lost my train of thought. Oh, so, yeah, I've made some stumbles along the way. But I have come from a life of dependency to a life of empowerment, and a life where I was the queen of inaction, refusing to make a decision, to making decisions and living with the consequences of those actions. And sometimes they work out and sometimes they don't. But I'm not afraid to fail anymore. And because of that, I finally started telling people and telling myself what I really want to do is be a writer. And I just had my first book published at age 50 last month. Thank you. I did not, if I had tried to describe the life that I expected or wanted or hoped for 21 years ago, I would have sold myself short. It took a long time for me to really leap out of bed with any enthusiasm on a regular basis. I would say it took 10 years for me. And I'm glad I'm not psychic, and I'm glad I did not know that 21 years ago, because I may not have made the decision I made. But I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did what they said. I'm glad I kept coming back. And I'm so, so grateful for this program. And I really appreciate you guys being here and listening to me tonight. Thanks.